So we ran our three-hour marathon attempt last weekend in Georgina, Ontario. I guess after the toughest 18-week training program we've ever done, trying to run a marathon faster than basically we've ever done. The temperature was cool and the course was fairly flat, but extremely windy. At halfway, I would say Liz and I were perfectly on target and around about 1 hour, 29, 50, 45, something like that. We kind of turned around. It was in double out and back. We sort of finished congratulating ourselves on our pacing and saying, you know, we're on target. And then we ran smack into a huge headwind that battered us for the next 2 kilometers, probably kilometer 24 and 25, and put us straight behind target. So we were off target. Personally, I decided, okay, I have to fight. I'm going to just fight the wind, try to get back onto pace. I couldn't really do that. It was just too hard. I was pulling ahead of Liz, but still below target pace. Towards the end, my pace dropped off really badly in the last 5K, probably because of the fighting I'd done against the wind earlier, and I came in at 3:04:49. I shouldn't be unhappy because that's the best time I've done since 1998. So that's my 23-year PR. So I guess I shouldn't be unhappy with that, but it kind of stings. What about you, Liz?
Well, I was happy at the turnaround because I knew that I wouldn't have to fight that wind anymore. But I saw that you had gotten quite a bit ahead, so I knew I wouldn't have the reassurance to run alongside a teammate for the remaining 10.5 kilometers. I was no longer able to hold the pace I needed for sub 3 hour marathon, never mind trying to get back the time we lost in the wind. But I tried hard to run the K I was in, and I thought, well, let's see how close I would get to the 3 hours. And since I didn't see you ahead of me because you were too far at that point, I thought, well, maybe you would get the sub 3 hour goal or very close to it. And despite having the wind at my back, that last 10K was the hardest of the whole race. I always forget that this is the way it is in all marathons because the last 10K is always the hardest. But with less than 200 meters left, I heard your name as you crossed the finish line. And I realized that in the end, we were actually not that far apart. You were only 15 seconds ahead of me.
Yeah, we ran slightly different races, but both got the same kind of result around 3:05. So after missing our A goals, B goals, C goals, and D goals achieved, but after missing our A goal, which was to run under 3 hours, we look back on the book that we're going to cover today. And guess what we decided that we would do? So hi, and welcome to the Running Book Reviews podcast, where we review running books to help you decide if you'd like to read the book for yourself. We also hope that listening to us chat about running can help keep you motivated about your own running and maybe inspire you to try something new and different. My name's Alan, with my co-host Liz. We're going to talk with author Des Dunham about his great book, Running Against the Odds, My Journey to Make High School Sports History.
So Running Against the Odds is a testament that past traumas and emotional blockades stand no chance against motivation, willpower, and can only fuel the desire to become a champion and emerge victorious. This book is Coach Dez's memoir. He divides his journey into three parts: his childhood, his college years, and his coaching. His journey starts with a turbulent childhood, which is when he also discovered running. He initially only tries out for the cross-country team because it is his ticket to get on the basketball team, but ends up loving the sport. Dez's childhood is not easy. His father is an alcoholic and ended up spending the money Dez's parents had tried to save for his education. He later manages to get a scholarship, but also loses it and must find a way to pay for his studies. Despite all the early challenges, Desmond gets a degree and becomes one of the most prolific coaches in high school cross country and track and field, and a very caring and compassionate human being. Running Against the Odds is a reminder that you're not alone with all the challenges that the world presents. A little bit about the author. Desmond Dunham is now a coach, mentor, and Under Armour coach ambassador, but he started out as a very driven young runner who risked his health to run in a championship meet in his last year of college eligibility. Coach Dunham is a youth sports expert with over 2 decades of coaching and teaching experience. He is a community leader and truly cares about every athlete he coaches. He has gone as far as having missed bill payments to pay for his athletes to have competitive experiences that their parents didn't have the means to send them to. Coach Dunham founded Kids Elite Sport, a youth sports development organization that operates summer camps and specialized training for committed youth athletes seeking a competitive edge in their primary sport. The Kids Elite Sports mission emphasizes promoting an active, healthy lifestyle that kids can sustain into their adult lives. Since its inception, Kids Elite Sport has impacted nearly 800 youngsters through summer camps and has hired and trained nearly 500 high school and college camp counselors. I don't know if I'm missing anything, but with all of that, we are so happy to have you on the podcast, Des. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm truly excited to be here, and I just really appreciate this opportunity.
So I guess we'll start with the first question, which is always, how did you decide to write this book?
So I think it was about a little bit over a decade ago when I was giving a pep talk, a motivational talk to my athletes. And I'll never forget one of the young ladies, she stayed behind everyone else. And they left, I mean, they were all super pumped and motivated. And I had just given them one of my stories, where I overcame adversity and triumphed over just a failing forward type of story. And I remember her saying to me, you should write a book. And she was so pumped. And what she was saying to me was that other people need to hear these messages. You know, you don't want to just keep this just for the team. And so I made that commitment roughly about a decade ago that I was going to write a book. And so it really resonated with me. And then the pandemic hit and I was thinking, if I don't do it now, it may not get done for a long period of time. And I mean, I'm super busy. And so that was kind of the impetus of me writing Running Against the Odds. And here it is. I thought it was going to be a 6 to 8 month process. It ended up being a year and a half. And it was such an arduous task. I always say it felt like I was preparing to run a 5K and then someone just dumped me into an ultra marathon. It was a lot of long nights, 4 or 5 a.m. mornings, and I'm super excited it's done. It's the number one new release on Amazon at the moment. So I couldn't ask for a better outcome of my memoir.
Yeah, it's super, well, it's super readable. So if it's number one on Amazon, I think people will find that out very quickly. It starts with your childhood, and you grew up in a city called Gary in Indiana.
Yes.
I didn't know anything about Gary, but I looked it up on the internet, and I saw that it was a pretty tough place to grow up. Certainly, yeah. It seems to have got worse just recently, I think, because of steelwork right. Shutting down and stuff like that. So, yes. What was it like in Gary, Indiana, in your childhood?
Yeah, so I mean, at one point, Gary was a booming city. During the 1950s and 60s, you had the Great Migration, where a lot of African Americans moved from the South to work within the steel industry. And Gary became one of the first steel cities in terms of, well, a steel town. And a lot of things were just constructed around the steel mill industry. And so when we started to lose bid from overseas, it started to decline the production of steel. And of course you had either workers being furloughed or they were, you had it where they were, released from their employment. And so when the steel industry started to take a turn, so did the city of Gary. And so that started happening in the 80s. And so when unemployment started to go up, so did crime, so did drug use, so did homicides. In the 1990s, Gary ended up becoming the homicide capital of the US. And that was per capita. And unfortunately, there was no stimulus packages that were given to Gary to so that one could maintain their living needs and take care of their expenses. And so you just started to see the city on this seesaw where it was just tipping. And I always, you know, I have this, there's this duality of the city where I really love my community, but there was also some things that as a child, unfortunately, there were just some resources that were not privy to me nor some of my community and neighborhoods that it really turned some lives for the worst. And I'm just so thankful. And it was actually running that changed the trajectory of my life. And that's where I hold running near and dear to my heart to this day.
Yeah, I think like you really do kind of say that during the book, how running was, even though it wasn't your first choice of sport, it definitely, you know, you definitely grew to love it. I guess the other thing that you talk a lot about, at least at the beginning of the book, is family. Because, you know, there were some difficulties in your family, but you had some strong people in your family as well, your mother, and you had other people around. What was family like?
Yeah, so I'm super blessed with the fact that I come from a family where, you know, we take our family reunions very seriously. sometimes on my Dunham side, which is my dad's side, we can easily have a bit over 200 family members and also close friends that we've adopted as family members. And so, and then on my mother's side, the Wilson family, we have really elaborate family reunions and gatherings for both. So, I mean, it is just such a wonderful atmosphere for you to grow up in. I mean, there's a lot of love, there's a lot of hugs, there's a lot of support. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is the place where you want to feel the safest and you want to feel the most love and support is within your home. And the unfortunate thing was that my dad served as a Vietnam veteran and was a Vietnam soldier. He's a veteran and he was responsible for collecting bodies off of the battlefield, injured soldiers, dead soldiers. And so when he returned home, unfortunately, there were some other things that returned with him and he didn't get the mental therapy and the mental health that he needed to, you know, kind of deprogram himself from what he had experienced and you know, how does a person go on as if certain things didn't happen or you didn't see certain things? And as a result of that, he developed the abuse of alcohol, which led to some abuse within the home with my mother and then some mental and emotional abuse with my sister and I. We just witnessed some things where we didn't feel like our home was a safe haven for us. And so I'm dealing with that with my dad. I also was identified with a speech impediment at an early age. And so I wasn't a cool kid getting pulled out of class, you know, with the speech therapist. And then I also have dyslexia as well. So the list goes on and on. And so I absolutely loved school initially. And then as I started to get older, you know, second, third grade, I noticed that there were some things that were different about me. And that made school not as fun for me. So I still managed to still have some really good teachers. And then again, it was the tryout, my ninth grade year, where not only was it the running, it was also the coach of my high school team that became a father figure for me. That was the last piece that I really needed was that male mentorship, because I had a phenomenal mother. She would work 24 to 28 hour shifts just to provide for my sister and I. And who would have known going out for that team? And I will also say that prior to going out my ninth grade year for cross country, I had already been cut from two school basketball teams, and I had been cut from my middle school cross country team, which is unheard of. But
everybody.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And we unfortunately had a coach, you know, there were 80 guys that were going out, and he's thinking, all right, if I got to take 80 guys, I have to work my tail off. I'm not going to work that hard. So I'm going to take 20 to 25 guys, and more of us got cut than he kept on the team. And so that was my experience. And so needless to say that when I went out ninth grade year, I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but I knew one thing. I had a chip on my shoulder, and that chip ended up just paving the rest of my entire life in terms of my experiences in high school. I garnered a scholarship to Howard University, where I went on to have a pretty good Division I running career. And that also just led me to other opportunities in life. So I'm so thankful that I did go out for that ninth grade cross country team.
Yeah, I guess this coach Chief that you refer to in the book turned out to be a pretty central character in your yes. in your life at that age. I think in the book he says something like, because you're turning up to get on the cross country in order to keep your basketball, to not get cut from the basketball team to begin with. And I think yes. he says something like, well, just keep up with the guys, otherwise you're out. And you haven't done that much running, and you're sort of pitched into one and done type of opportunity. It sounded like a pretty tough love. Tell us a bit about Chief.
Going out for that ninth grade year, going out for the cross country team proved to be just so powerful in my life in so many ways. And one of the added benefits I got from joining the cross country team in high school was the fact that my high school track coach became a mentor in my life. And him being a mentor in my life just helped to really shape and mold me from all the other great things that my mother had planted in me. You know, I always say this, that it was great to have, you know, such a strong mother. And I mean, she was just incredible with just her relentless dedication and commitment to our family. And as I mentioned before, working 24 plus hours, but I also needed that male mentor that was going to, or that male father figure that was going to just kind of help to shape and mold me and to figure some things out as a male in Gary, Indiana. And my high school track coach, I mean, he was more than a father figure to me, where he also had some challenges growing up where his mother was a sharecropper. And so he paved his own way with the help of others. And that was his DNA that he passed on to me. And that's what I pass on to the athletes that I currently coach, and where we don't take no for an answer. If there's something out there that we want to go after, then the only thing that's standing in the way is air and opportunity. And sometimes in life, you just got to get out of your own way and make things happen on a daily basis until you get what you are capable of achieving. And that was just something that was planted in us over and over again through training and through just his guidance. And I'm so appreciative of having Chief in my life.
I think one of the things about having a mentor is, I guess, seeing somebody that is sort of like you achieve things that you might think are impossible. And it seems like Chief was that person. So there was one quote that I feel like it sort of represents a lot of things that you went on to do. So Chief used to say, champions and successful people get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I can imagine as a teenager who lived a lot of uncomfortable situations, you know, with your family life and, you know, with school being difficult at first and all those things, you probably wanted your life to be a little easier. But having Chief say that to you seems like it motivated you. So what did that saying mean to you?
You know, the one thing that it maybe not resonated with me initially in terms of just the role that it would end up playing long-term in my life, it made a lot more sense the older I got. I do know that running was a microcosm of life within our program, as running should be for most people. Running is it could be for everyone. It's you against yourself. And so, but he made us achieve some things that we would only dream about achieving. When my freshman year, I was running 21 minutes and my goal was to break 20 minutes. And so I remember running 19:54 my freshman year in 5K, but I'm looking at these other guys run from some of the suburban schools and all these guys are running 15 and 16 minute 5Ks. And I'm thinking these guys are gods. And I'm thinking there's no way. And lo and behold, my senior year, I ended up running 16:15. Not to take that lightly, but there was a lot of miles that took place. But I think at the end of it all was the simple fact that something that I dreamt about, something that I didn't even think I was capable of achieving, he was always there to dangle that carrot and he was always there to make sure that we didn't shortchange ourselves. And that was something that transferred over, and he challenged me in the classroom that way. So eventually the tenacity that I had with training and on the cross country course became the tenacity that I started to have within the classroom. And then it became the tenacity that I started having when I was involved in organizations. And then later on, it became college and then work and now coaching. And so it just started to make a lot more sense the older I got, that how you do anything is how you do everything. And he definitely planted those seeds. And when I ran the 16:15, I mean, it was a dream come true. And I reflected on the fact that I didn't think I was very talented. You know, I ran with another guy who was a Foot Locker finalist. And well, it was Kenny at that time. And he's running 15 minutes and like low 15s. And that was talent there. And he worked hard. So it was a lot of guidance, as well as Chief really got us to dream and to dream bigger and to just set those long-term goals.
You ended up being so successful that you it was time to go to college, and you had a choice between two. So you were either going to go to Howard or Purdue University.
Yes.
And it sounds like this was the first time that your dad kind of had any input regarding school. He really wanted you to go to Purdue University, and Chief encouraged you to go to Howard, and you actually ended up following his advice instead of your father's advice. But why did your dad all of a sudden have an opinion about where you went to school?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's just really unfortunate where the comfortability was to stay close to home. And there was also this uncomfortableness about Howard being a historically Black college. And it's really unfortunate, though, that being an African-American, we didn't really have the curriculum in our school systems that really taught us our culture and who we were. One thing that Chief told me is that you have to go to Howard because it will help to affirm who you are. And he also said, you know, you'll never know where you're going until you know where you've been, which I thought it was, I mean, if Chief said it, enough said, that was one thing. But I mean, it proved to be true that that it was at Howard that I really saw how strong I was as just a human being. That, you know, unfortunately, you through the media, you learn that unfortunately sometimes that you feel like you're a second-class citizen with some of the things that as an African-American male that you have to go through and some of the things you see, and you're just kind of conditioned and you're kind of given a place and you put yourself in that place, unfortunately, where you're not dreaming as big. And even interviewing some of my family members, you know, it kicked up a lot of dust with some of the things we talked about, but I'll never forget, you know, one of my aunts that I look up to dearly, she says, look, Desmond, there were two things that we knew that we had to do to be successful as an African-American family. And that was join the military or get a good office desk. You know, that's not what you're dreaming about when you're 6, 7 years old. And somehow, you know, through the school systems in Gary and this exists other places that you just lose those dreams and those hopes and passions. And Howard really just gave me a spark to show that everyone on the face of this earth deserves love, peace, and happiness. And you definitely deserve that opportunity to live out your dreams. And so I'm so thankful that I was able to come here to the East Coast and to go to an illustrious university. I mean, I really had no idea what I was getting myself into going to Howard, but it definitely shaped who I was as a person. And it made me feel like I was super blessed. And as a coach, I want to bless everyone. I want to, but it's hard to navigate through life when you feel hopeless, and Howard gave me a lot of hope. It just made me appreciate myself and everyone that I come in contact with.
I think one thing that comes out from your book, certainly when I read it, and you don't push it, and it's not a storyline, and it's not a theme in your book, but one thing that comes out kind of as a byproduct of you just telling your story is some of the difficulties and challenges and plight of the Black Americans in many ways.
Yeah.
And as somebody who's, you know, a white guy who's non-American, you hear stories and you hear the advocates of both both sides of the fence, but you don't really get a feel for it because you're not in there. You're not, I don't live in the USA. I haven't, you know, lived through these cultures. And a nice thing in your story that comes almost naturally out is an insight. And that's, for me, that was an extra bonus in the book, because I don't want people lecturing me and telling me how it is for, you know, Black Lives Matter and all of that. And there's a certain amount of white rebound or resistance to that. So I think the way you're just telling your story and you were just able to, you know, live through your childhood and in the book, you know, it was a superb advocacy for some of the difficulties that the Black Americans have.
Yeah.
Congratulate you on that. I don't know, you probably did it by accident. You're just doing your thing and it came out like that.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And there was a little bit of intentionality to it. I just hope that my story can just lead to even some tough discussions where, I mean, again, when you're 5, 6, 7 and you're on the playground, you know, there's no race, there's no differences. And, you know, these things are just created. They're manufactured. And then there's a thing that your zip code sometimes determines your opportunities in life. And that shouldn't be the case. Everyone should have an equal opportunity, early childhood education, to just feeling like you can have the same education as your, you know, counterpart. And that's, Alan, that's where it really starts, where education is everything. And there's this perpetual cycle where the certain low socioeconomic areas are just not given the education. I mean, even that, I remember traveling to the Dominican Republic, and I took my son there for a baseball camp that was held in Cusuelo, and it was a very poor area. And unfortunately, these kids had to rotate a third of the year to attend school. So with that being said, there's no opportunity there for that area to actually turn around, because it's education that gives us the most opportunity and the most hope. And there's a glowing statistic in the United States that by third grade, if you are one reading level behind by third grade, you unfortunately increase the opportunity of dropping out of high school by 50%. That's when high school doesn't become fun for you, because you're now two or three reading levels behind and you're trying to navigate all the madness in your community and all the stress. And you know, I had no idea what distance running was doing for me, but I learned later that, you know, the endorphins and all the other hormones that were being secreted were countering some of the stress that I was having from home. And even to this day, you know, if I have a rough day, my wife says, hey, you need to go out for a run. and I literally come back a different person. And I just have to say that running is not running. Running is life. And anyone who is a distance runner can attest that you are a different person if you learn to appreciate running from a healthy perspective. And I know we have goals, but being able to put one foot in front of the other is such a special thing that we should just not take for granted. And to this day, I run about 30, 40 miles a week, and it makes me a totally different person. I do my best thinking. I'm the best version of myself when I'm running. And if I'm dealing with stress, it just peels off so many layers of that stress by the time, you know, I cross the finish line. And so didn't know all the science behind it before, you know, the endorphins, the serotonin, the adrenaline, and all of those things. But studying it now, it makes all the sense in the world that really helped me to make some healthier decisions and to deal with all the craziness that I was having to deal with on a daily basis.
I think also there's something to say about the community, because I think that's the other thing that we get from running, even as adults, because once you're an adult and you've left school, you don't have that proximity with other people as much. You know, yes, you go to work, but you go to work and most people have like lives outside of work. So you never really create there's no real friendships. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't want to say that because
you might have a friend or two that
I do. I do like some of the people I work with, but you know, it's not the same. Whereas like the people I run with, yeah, like Alan, you know, you go even now as adults, you go, let's say we all go to the same marathon. So we'll plan like team races. So we all go and we spend the whole weekend together and you get to know each other better. It's kind of, it's something that like you can keep when you're a runner that you maybe kind of lose after you leave school. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's that common struggle. And, you know, it's that struggle that you're identifying that struggle and you're towing the line with, you know, some folks that you're struggling sometimes with those distance runs and relating to each other. And then you got a lot of common goals in mind and you just learn to lean on one another. And I mean, there's just nothing like it. And so you are formulating that team, you know, effort. And And you can't help but to formulate that common bond just through, you know, just the daily sacrifices that you're making. And so the same things that I talk about in running against the odds with my team, it sounds like that's pretty much how your running club is also orchestrated as well.
I guess before we go on to your coaching, because you coached some pretty successful teams and there were some really exciting races in the book, but maybe you can just talk to us a little bit about, you know, about your university experience. Like, you did leave home for the first time and you were far from home. And you described in the book how you got off the phone with your mom and you cried, which, you know, like most people don't want to admit, but then afterwards you were like, okay, I need to create a community. So what happened? How did you get over that initial hump of being all on your own?
Yeah. So I realized that I was super lonely and the safety net, I mean, the training wheels, everything was gone. My mother also knew that this was a special opportunity. And one of the things she said was, coming back home is not an option. And so sometimes when we give ourselves options in life, we tend to sometimes not go full force towards some of those goals. And that's kind of what we were talking about with your 3 minutes. And you know, if you give yourself the option, then, I mean, chances of you getting under that 3 minutes, I mean, it becomes more slim. It's not impossible, but I think that when you become fixated on things and you don't give yourselves an option, you figure it out. The body is resilient, it adapts, and you just have to be consistent in going after, you know, those daily goals that's going to get you to the long-term goal. And so I think when my mother said that, I realized that, wow, there's not a lot of options here. And so I sat there, I felt lonely, I felt depressed, and I sat there and cried. And then after the tears, and Chief used to always say something to us. It was a kind of paraphrase this African proverb where he says, when the sun rises in Africa, the gazelle better start running. The lion will also need to run, because either you're going to get eaten or you need to eat. But either way, when that sun comes up, you got to be ready to run. He used to say that as a motivation where you don't have time to wallow in your pity. You know, he used to always say, I'm going to give you 24 hours, but when that sun comes up, you got to make a decision. And that was very similar to my a race that I ran in high school where I prepared for this race. I thought I was going to sit in these 10, you know, one of these 10 chairs that they had set up for the top finishers. And I ended up getting 75th in this race. And I mean, I was totally dejected. And I threw the ribbon down, it went into the mud. Chief saw it. He had me to pick it up because, you know, he was an advocate for always being sportsmanlike. And that was part of the story he gave me. And when I wake up that next morning, I have got to be that gazelle or lion. I needed to be running towards whatever goals that I had. So I took that ribbon and I put it next to my light switch. And every single morning, I turned my light switch, I flicked it on, and it reminded me of those goals that I needed to achieve. And so when I thought I was working hard, I realized there was some room for me to become more dedicated. There was room for me to eat better. There was room for me to do more strength work. I even added an additional 10 miles. I was running close to 80 miles in high school. So that ribbon is what actually propelled me to running 16:15 the following year. That's what propelled me to getting a track and cross country scholarship. And so, you know, you talk about failing, but unfortunately we have this negative relationship with failing, but the most success that we have in life actually comes from failing. And so it's a bit twisted, but we have to, and especially being a runner, it just kind of comes with the territory. But when we embrace failing, we got to be willing to, you know, to be like an Albert Einstein who failed at 1,000 experiments, and it was 1,001 that he, you know, but all you hear about is that 1,001st experiment. And that just has to be our mantras in life, and that, you know, no one loves to fail, but we got to embrace it and not be so hard on ourselves when we do, but be willing to go back to the lab and figure out, okay, what could we have done better? What can, you know, I hear you guys, you know, already I'm assessing as a coach, you know, finding the windiest strips and running against those, you know, windy strips and even, you know, doctoring some of your training with against the wind, or more hill work, more resistance type training, parachutes, you know, harness, all those types of things that, okay, we know one of the problems. So let's start addressing that now. How can I relax mm-hmm. against the wind? Well, to me, that's just kind of life right there, where at times we don't know when that wind is going to be at our face. You know, and that's what running, that's what everything we deal with, and with relationships, with careers, with, I mean, it goes on and on. We're dealing with a lot, but we're resilient. We can adapt, and we can train our minds, our bodies, our spirits to endure, you know, those obstacles.
Yeah, Liz, one of the things we did due to the fact that we talked to people like you in all our podcasts is, was when we took on our marathon challenge, we said, okay, what we're going to do here is we're going to invest in a joyous process of training. Yeah. Plus or minus joy at times, but and then we're going to get either success or we're going to get learning.
Yes.
There's no failure.
Right.
There's no sense of failure.
I love it.
We're either going to get success, or we're going to get information as a gift towards our next round.
I love it.
And if you do that, then you don't have a feeling of being defeated.
Right.
Because if you're on the start line, you're already a winner. It's just a question of which prize you're going to get. Are you going to get the success, or are you going to get the learning? I would hope I don't get always the learning. But there you go.
You're going to be a really smart guy.
Or dumb, because I only get the same lesson. I don't learn it. One of the things, you know, when we talk about, you know, motivation and you know, you hear these great words that you've just given us, really, is, you know, people go, oh, it's kind of okay for those guys, you know, what about me? And I think one of the fantastic things about your book is you probably had more than the average number of challenges, so it's good to see that. And you went off the rails a little bit at times, I think, in the book. It seemed like in college you tried to take on too much. You got fairly obsessed with getting into the Alpha Phi Alpha frat, which is probably a great thing to do, because you got to do an African cultural exchange.
Yeah.
And that probably had some life changing. So how did you deal with, you know, having trouble fitting everything into college? And
And you know, I think a lot had to do with the lack of opportunities I felt growing up, where, I mean, when I got to college, it was just amazing with all of the resources and opportunities that were there before me. And so, yeah, I wanted to experience it all. And I think I was a kid in a candy store. And I mean, those were just some great days. But I also knew it was something special about the fraternity, where I wanted to, I mean, they were pillars in a community, and they were just a staple on campus with solid programming, from financing to entrepreneurship and And so I knew I needed to be around something else that was going to shape and mold me for life. And the one gentleman that became a mentor to me at Howard was also the president of Alpha Phi Alpha. So, you know, he didn't do it intentionally, but I wanted to emulate him. And I knew that I had the challenges of a speech impediment. I knew I had the challenges of dyslexia. But I wanted to be that figure that could speak well in front of others and motivate others and change other people's lives. It was just such a powerful feeling what Chief had done for me, what he had done for me, and I wanted to do it for others. And I knew that that was, you know, I came to Howard, I didn't have the confidence, I didn't have the assurance. I was just kind of felt like I was given this opportunity because of running, open up the door for me, but I didn't wholeheartedly felt like I belonged there. That's what I was, again, I had to make a decision, and the decision I made was iron sharpens iron. I'm gonna hang around the sharpest guys I can find. And I was very fortunate. My next door neighbor had come from a science and tech and magnet program. I mean, I think he had a semester's worth of college credits when he came in from his high school alone. He's from New York. And
wow.
And it was such a stark contrast from my experiences. And I'm scratching my head on the, like, wait, how did you got college credits? And so, I put myself around the right people. And I think that's super important that you, in life, we all have to watch the circle of folks that we put ourselves around. You know, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can only be transferred. And if you put yourself around positive people, sharp people, it's going to rub off on you, you know. And if you put yourself around the negative Nancys, and I mean, it's going to make things a lot more challenging for you. And I mean, that's just kind of how the human spirit works. And so fast forward, I become a member eventually, and I'm very thankful of that. But we ended up doing a South African cultural exchange program shortly after the apartheid. This is where, I mean, Howard changed my life, but going to South Africa, witnessing the effects of apartheid and seeing communities with 4, 5, 6 member families living in 300 square feet, you know, houses. And there was, the restroom was a shared community, maybe a quarter of a mile away from the house. The floors were...
This was in Soweto?
Soweto, yes, Soweto. And the roofs were tin roofs with holes in it. So when it rained, it, you know, it came in, and it was just, and I actually went to South Africa just a bit down and out because my college career did not finish the way I had hoped. I ended up getting bronchitis that led into pneumonia, and I still competed. And of course, I didn't tell
a true runner.
Yeah, I wasn't going to let my teammates down. And that was just my last hurrah. And it was just something that I was willing to give up a lot to toe the line and to be there with my teammates. And so it was a bit crazy. But at the same time, I'm glad that I was able to do it and finish it, not how I wanted to, but. So when I fast forward, I get to the Soweto townships, and here it is, I'm complaining and I'm down and out, and I've made this molehill into a mountain where I realize that in the Soweto townships, there are no organized teams. There's no opportunities to run through the community. Matter of fact, there were a lot of children who didn't even have shoes. And all I thought about was I could have been born anywhere in the world. You know, no one chooses where you're born, you know, but I could have easily have been born there with no opportunities to ever know what it even feels like to go on a distance run. And it was one of the most humbling experiences that I had ever had in my entire life. And it really opened up my eyes to the world. It opened up my eyes to say, Desmond, you get out of your own way. Stop making your small, you know, first world problems into these major mountains. The fact that you were able to run in high school, in college, to have teammates, to have organized sports, to have clean water, the list goes on and on. And that's also one of the reasons I'm so vulnerable in running against the odds, is because I want to plant seeds in our younger generations too, to get them to understand that the world, I mean, if there's going to be any major changes, you know, we're kind of finishing our relay leg, and we need them to carry the baton to make their community better, other people's community better, to make the world better. And so going to South Africa, it just really confirmed that I wanted to live a life that was going to make substantial changes in other people's lives. And I've been able to do that as a coach, as a teacher, and as a owner of a sports camp.
But you were supposed to be a doctor. So
yes.
So how come you decided to be a coach?
So yeah, it was my graduate year at Howard. So I decided to stay and do my baccalaureate program to get all my medical school prerequisites. I had also done biomedical research at Indiana University, and those things were going really well for me. But another thing that happened was we had a local elementary school that was really struggling. I ended up getting a few of my buddies to tutor over at the school with me. And then one day the principal just broke down when we were having a conversation. And she informed me that they were losing their funding the next year for all of their special programs, which was their foreign language and music. Well, Howard has some of the most talented and brilliant musicians and has a really strong foreign language department. So I ended up and this is also kind of where I met my wife as well, where she became my director of operations. And we put out a call across the campus, and we ended up getting over 100 Howard students to volunteer at that local elementary school. We ran their entire foreign language for the next 2 years, and also their music program. And we did mentoring with the elementary students. And it was such an amazing experience. And I had just never gotten that feeling with anything I had ever done. I had started coaching at a local middle school, and I was just sold on it. And so when I just thought about the idea of leaving, you know, from that environment, it just never sat well with me, even to the point when I was about to still leave, my truck broke down, which gave me another day to think about it. And then I called my mother, and she ended up just saying, listen, follow whatever passions you have, just be the best you can be at whatever you do. That's all I asked. She just wanted me to be happy. So once she ended up sharing with me that she's going to love me no matter what I decide, it gave me the permission to follow my heart. And that's exactly what I did. And over two decades later, here I am. I'm still loving coaching. Very fortunate to get National Coach of the Year in 2019. And so some things are still going well, and I still have the spark, and I'm just going to go until my engine burns out.
And you still love running, that's for sure, because yes. You wrote a whole book about it.
Yes, 100%. Yes.
I love that you brought up your wife, Jamie, because, you know, it seems like she is just as caring and compassionate as you.
Yes.
And actually, there was a part in the book that describes how you had a truck in front of your house one day. Your neighbor knocks at your door because they want to tow your car. And so your wife didn't understand why they towed the car. And you had to tell her that you hadn't made some of the payments because you had used the money instead to pay for some of your athletes to go to a competition, which was very, very noble. But like, I have to say that your wife, I mean, you know, there are some wives that would have handed you divorce papers, and she
she might have been having them drawn up, and I don't know about it, but yeah.
It seems like it was an ongoing theme for a little while in your life that you just kind of, you know, every time you saw somebody in need, you would just dig deeper in your pocket and just try and give them whatever they needed. Yeah. When did you finally realize that you do have to look after yourself and your family?
Yeah, I think that, it was definitely when we ended up having our first child, which is Niles, and he's 16 now. He's a soccer player, and we have a daughter. She's 14 and also a soccer player, and 15. She just turned 15 2 days ago. And so it was when we had my son, and I realized that, you know, here it is. I'm one of the top coaches in the country, but I really hadn't monetized some of my strengths, and I wasn't going about it. And unfortunately, I overcompensated, and I still do, with some of the things I didn't have that I want to make sure that my athletes feel, you know, that they have a coach that's super dependable or someone in their life that's a constant. And you know, dealing with everything with my dad, I realized that I never want another person to experience the letdowns that I had as a child. And so I'll never forget where, you know, one day I'm going to, you know, got a ton of groceries and I'm in the checkout and I give the cashier my card and that card doesn't work. And then the next card doesn't work. And I'm thinking, you know, this can't stay like this. I now have some little people. Mm-hmm. And I've always had this attitude where I don't need a whole lot. if I can be with family and have some, you know, fun with friends, and I can coach and teach, I'm a happy camper. But then, of course, I mean, it was a complete eye-opener having now a newborn and knowing that I have to provide for him. And eventually one day he's going to go to college. And I end up reading Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And it just talks about the 10,000 hours of expertise. And that really just got my wheels turning. And I'm thinking, I mean, I'm a sports expert. I'm a youth sports expert. And so that kind of propelled me. I started a massage therapy business that went well. Then I ended up pivoting over to starting a camp. And the first year we were having the camp, I had to cancel it because we didn't have enough campers. Then the second year I had to tweak the model, and we were entering the first week of camp and I had hired 25 counselors and we had 10 campers enrolled. So, and so, you know, it's so funny when I tell this story because, you know, whoever I'm telling it to, they're looking at me and they're like, wait, did you mean the other way around that you had 25? No, we had a 2-to-1 ratio of counselors, but, you know, it was, I did all of the math, I analyzed everything. I knew we had a unique model. And I knew that it was I just felt great about it. And fast forward, here it is now. We serve close to 1,000 campers. We have 4 different sites. I'm doing what I love to do. I'm doing it for the right reasons. And also I can control the amount of registration. So there's some camps that I feel like they just take advantage, you know, from a monetary standpoint. You know, we're pretty safe average, you know, fee for the camp. And so I'm able to now live in a world where I'm able to monetize some of my expertise and still do it for the right reasons and change lives through sports and running.
So you ended up with respect to coaching, you ended up consolidating your coaching to Eleanor Roosevelt High School and pushing those guys. And there's a couple of chapters which are extremely exciting around the development of those guys. But initially, they didn't really have a team. You wanted to get them into the championship. And it looked like initially, based on ability, you should get chosen for a Portland. I think it was championships in Portland. And you didn't get chosen. You didn't let that stop you. But why did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I still don't know the full story to that. I do know that there was some politics involved, that we ended up having a team that jumped over us. And this was a team that was in the same state championships we were in. So we actually ended up running the exact same course on the same day. And if you compared the results, we outran them. And then even the committee came back to say, well, you didn't run head to head against them. And I'm thinking, all right, where did this algorithm come from? And so, you know, you live in this world and you just realize that some things are just going to be unfair. And if you allow the unfairness to take hold of you, now you're really allowing that person or thing to keep control over you. Now you're giving them the power that you have. At that point, I refused to submit to that. And it made me even more tenacious as a coach. And I do know that there's been times that I've been lost in the coaching where I didn't have the balance that I needed to have. And I think that's something that we all have to be careful with as runners and understand that careers, it's not who we are, but it's something that we love to do. So I really got embedded into just more and trying to figure out how do we crack this code, but it made me a better coach. It still was some tough times that centered around us not making it that year, but I will say, I'll say to that committee now, thank you, because you ended up making me a better coach. And I think we end up getting better results. And I just knew that I was a new kid on the block. Things were not going to be given to me nor my team. And we just have to go out there and earn it and be that much better than those we competed against.
And you actually even managed to spark that fire in your athletes that year, because they were really disappointed too.
Yeah, they were. Yes.
So I don't know if you want to just maybe briefly tell everybody what's so special about the Penn relays. Like, why was it so disappointing that you guys didn't get to go?
So the Penn relays is the Super Bowl of track and field here in the United States for high school athletes. And what makes it so special is that you have teams coming from all over the United States, but then you also have teams coming in from Jamaica, which is, we go back and forth who has the most dominant program. But the Jamaican high school programs have just, I mean, dominated the Penn relay. So there's always this big to-do when you get an American team that's good enough to compete against the Jamaican schools. And then it becomes, you're no longer representing your school, you're representing the United States of America. When we lined up against the Jamaican schools, you would literally see big flags being waved by 2 and 3 people and whistles blowing and chanting USA and the other side, Jamaica. And it was in front of a crowd of 40,000 plus spectators. And so it's such a wonderful international competition. It's also been the longest running. I mean, it's been running for over a century. Unfortunately, COVID just ruined that. But as it has ruined everything else, it is just one of the premier high school track meets in the United States. And so it's kind of this David and Goliath story with our little old team from Greenbelt, Maryland, USA versus a few of the really dominant Jamaican teams. And it's a great story. I won't tell too much, but it is a nail biter. And I'm hoping that this story ends up on the big screen one day as well.
I think it would be nice to see. Mm-hmm. You do a great job in the book of painting the picture of some of your kids who are in the team and, you know, what they have to, what they have to do individually to get themselves to a point where they can be competitive with these Jamaican schools.
Yeah.
And what they deliver during some of the events, because there are multiple events, different distance relays. And I made fantastic reading. And while I was reading it, I could feel the tension rising and I could feel my excitement rising. And I thought this would be a great end to the movie, you know, Chariots of Fire type of movie. So if there are any movie producers listening to the podcast, who want to get in touch with Dez, you can negotiate the rights directly with Dez. Who are we going to get to play the athletes? I don't know. We'd have to get some youngsters. So.
Yeah, because those athletes are adults now, because that was in 2007.
Well, you know what? I've already gotten a lot of volunteers, and I haven't said this often to that I want this on the big screen. People are coming up to me now telling me, hey, this sounds like it could be a great Disney movie or, you know, just a great movie to, and I've heard Chariots of Fire and also just kind of referencing Miracle, the hockey story. And my runners will always say, hey, I'll volunteer to be, you know, such and such. Okay. And so I think I'll have a lot of former athletes that'll be volunteer, our current athletes that'll be volunteering to be a part of it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a fantastic climax to the book.
Thank you very much. Not just
what happens, but the way you tell it, the way you invest us in all the girls and their efforts.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So what's next for you? Any other book ideas or new business ventures?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. Well, first, I have released the ebook and the paperback. I'm currently working on the audiobook, a Spanish translation, and also a hardcover that will come out in spring 2022. And wow. on my personal website, I have a free downloadable teacher's guide. And so one of the areas that I would love to live in with the book is to do book talks, to talk to schools, to talk to teams. It could be businesses, it could be clubs, hint, hint, all right? And and so I would love to live in that world. Then I think I've already started taking notes for two more books and that I'm interested in writing. And the second book will be a more of a parents and coaches guide to having a healthier experience for their child in running and in sports. I'm definitely seeing a lot of unhealthy relationships with sports, and And I'm thinking, man, you know, parents, coaches, please do not ruin this for our younger generations. And everything is about the scoreboard. And instead of it, it's about the destination instead of being about the journey. You know, Alan and Liz, I know that you two wanted to run under 3 minutes and
3 hours.
But I know for a fact, just seeing how you all interact. And I mean, the most beautiful moments is the fact that you all have been able to formulate a relationship, a podcast, many days of, you know, just leaning on each other. We just really sometimes forget about how valuable and how blessed we are with the things that we're able to do. And I really feel like we, and especially in my area, that we have a lot of parents who are not as appreciative. And there's a lot of abuse, in a sense, emotional and mental abuse that's happening because a kid is being asked to do things that they don't feel like they have control over. You never have any control over if you score a touchdown or if you make a goal. You can only go out there and do your very best. And at the end of the day, you got to ask yourself, did you stretch yourself? Were you comfortable being uncomfortable? Because that's what we want to get out of sports. We want to become a better person. We want to develop some life lessons. We want to become a little bit more grittier, develop that stick-to-itiveness, and most of all, learn how to get along well with others, no matter who you are or where your background, what your background is. Now we're hearing me instead of we. And so that's my second book. And then the third book would be where I would pick up from 2008 and I would fast forward it to the end of my coaching career and reveal some other challenges that I went through. And, you know, I'm being super vulnerable because, Alan, I think you mentioned earlier that some people think that you're just, that you're wired a certain way. And they always think, and I've heard this a lot, you know, well, Coach Dunham, everyone can't be like you or think like you. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you really have no idea of what I've been through and that I've had some low moments in life. And I've doubted myself. And yeah, I get nervous but you know, they don't see me in that light. And part of me being vulnerable is to give other people permission to, you know, one, to know that you can achieve anything that you truly set your mind to. And then two, that, you know, everyone has problems, you know, in some form or fashion, and no one is going to be immune to that. And so, yeah, I want to just unveil a bit more that fast forward from 2008 all the way up. And so those are just some of the ventures that I have and in my mind. And yeah.
Yeah. I think that second book is actually a really important one because I mean, you see it sometimes where parents will be like, oh, my child is just not athletic. And so they won't register them in any sports and they won't push them to do sports, but you get a lot more out of it than just like making it to the Olympics, which is sort of, you know, what a lot of people, you know, kind of say, well, if you're not going to make it to the Olympics, what's the point? But there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. Mm. Or if you do make the Olympics, I mean, using your platform just to make the world better and not be so self-centered that you make it all about you. And unfortunately, you know, you see some horrible attitudes with elite athletes too. So that's this book is to challenge parents and coaches. What is the goal here? And to really, you know, get them thinking about just making and producing better humans.
I used to be a soccer coach back in the day in Australia, and I used to coach one of the really technically challenged teams, let's say. And I used to say, look, you know, let's just run our game plan and give it our best. We used to lose 80% or more of the games. They used to say, look, you can't control that. Those guys are good. What we can control is at the cheer at the end, we're going to be the loudest cheer. And we used to always do that. So look, we can control that. We got control of that.
Yeah.
And everybody would be smiling, saying, yes, we did it again. We cheered the loudest.
I love it. I love it.
You gotta find it. You know, look for the positives and find out where you can find it. Just listening to you, one, I want to be a coach now. Liz is already a coach. But I think the whole world are going to be wanting to be coaches when they hear this podcast. Two, it's great. We're going to be talking to you again in a year's time, because we know it takes you about a year to write a book. So the next one will be out in a year.
I'm not committing to a year. I'm going to give a little bit of time.
Okay. Okay. You got to work up your commitment first.
Yeah.
No, but that would be great. And in the meantime, you know, if people want to follow you, your exploits, get in touch with you, you know, connect with your training programs, or just find out what you're up to. How did you do that, Des?
Yeah, they can follow me on Instagram at Coach Des Dunham. That's Coach DezDunham. And then I also have a website, www.coachdesdunham.com. And you can follow me on Facebook at Desmond Dunham. And I would love for some of the listeners out here to reach out and follow and just see what's the latest and greatest coming from Coach Des. My summer camp is called Kids Elite Sports, and you can always look us up at www.kidselitesports.com.
Okay, that's great.
I'll link all those in the notes.
Thank you very much.
And with respect to your book, is there anywhere in particular you'd like people to go to get a copy if they want to?
Oh, yes. It's currently a number one new release on Amazon, and Running Against the Odds. You can find it on Amazon.com. And I do have an ebook special that will last until October 31st and for 99 cents. And then you can also find the paperback on Amazon as well.
Yeah, this podcast is due to come out on the 1st of November, so people will have missed their chance for the ebook special. Okay, maybe we should just wrap things up with a little summary of our views. Maybe I could just give my summary on the book and all my thoughts, and I'll let you give yours, Liz.
Okay.
You know, what I would say about the book is, you know, there are great running stories in the book, but there are also many life lessons, you know, things like follow your passion, believe in yourself, don't give up, don't be put off by others, don't be put off by failures initially. All those things apply to your whole life. And I think you said, you know, running is life in many ways earlier on. The race descriptions of the pen relay races against the elite girls from the Jamaican teams are absolutely gripping and make fantastic reading. And if you buy it just to read through and get to that point, there's some great, if you're a runner, you need to read those stories. So get the book and read it through. It's great to see the USA Black community representation in school running. We don't always see that first. So it's great to see that. And it's a great aspect of the book, I think. We read the PDF, so I'm not sure if there are photographs in the hard copy. Would have been nice to see a few photographs of a young Des Dunham, see in the hood, and see what he was like. So we didn't see any photos. So that maybe a few future editions, you could get some photos out of the archives. But the book overall is an engaging story, exciting to read, and a credit to you, Des.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So I, along the same lines as Alan, but I also think that the book did a really good job of balancing the negative experiences that you had with the positive. It can be hard to see any positive in your life if you have an alcoholic father, especially when you're a young kid, because it, you know, your parents are sort of like your universe, and it can be very scary to see when they're angry. You know, your book very much does have that aspect to it. You do explain that difficult relationship with your father, but you focus more on all the great experiences that you had with the other more positive role models in your life, your mother, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, your teachers that, you know, pushed you to do better and try harder, and definitely your running coaches. I think it's a great reminder to anybody out there that's going through a hard time that you're not alone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Running Book Reviews. A big thank you to Jimmy Dwyer from Darwin Miller Public Relations for reaching out to let us know about this book and providing review copies and helping us to set up the interview. Thanks, Jimmy. Big thanks to Coach Des for spending time with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. If you'd like to leave us any feedback of how we can improve the podcast or want to suggest a book that you'd like us to review in the future, please leave us a comment on social media. We are Running Book Reviews on Facebook and Instagram, and on Twitter we are reviews_running. Please also follow us on social media so you can find out about new episodes when they are released. Or you can just subscribe to the podcast on your favorite streaming platform. That's all from Running Book Reviews. Bye for now.